vote is a paper about the set of comments about the persistence of empire. And, I mean, we've heard today that this concept of empire is now being widely used to describe the global order or an aspect of the global order or a pattern of global rule today. And this has happened very quickly, I think, the emergence of talking about empire and imperialism over the last 3 or 4 years. And it's being used now by both sides in the debate, those people who want to defend present order and those who want to criticize it and organize against it, to both see themselves as, in other words, defending or criticizing an empire or an imperial order of some kind or another. And this has happened before. During the war against Vietnam, imperialism became a way of talking about the pattern in the present, and earlier around decolonization in the 50s and 60s, people were for or against imperialism. It's come back in a big way now, and I think it's even right to say that it's kind of elbowed aside globalization as a concept, and modernization, and ways of thinking about the international order that were dominant prior to the last 3 or 4 years. So there's always been an undercurrent or on the periphery of contemporary thought and academic writing, the idea that we still live in an imperial age, but it was always, so to speak, on the sidelines, and now it's come back. And more people are seeing the present order and talking about it in that way, defending it in that way, but also resisting it. Millions of people on the planet are organizing against imperialism, world social forms, a classic example of that. And I think it really is a useful concept for disclosing at least some of the very complex relations of power that people have been talking about. And what I want to do in this talk is just to say a few things, try to clarify a few features of imperialism as it exists in its present formation. And I want to make two sets of comments. One is first a comment about the historically layered character of contemporary imperial relations. And that's the persisting side of the talk, the persistence of imperial relationships that have been laid down over the last 500 years. The second set of notes I want to make about the way imperialism is used today is a new feature of imperialism today, and that's its informal character. That's to say that imperial power isn't exercised through colonies, but in a post-colonial age, through informal mechanisms that I want to talk about in the second part of the paper. So let me talk first about 500 years of Western imperialism and the kind of structures of inequality and violence that have been laid down and are permanent and have persisted through this period of decolonization in the 20th century. Historically, Western imperialism has gone through three main phases. A very long period from 1492 right up to about 1914, the period of Western colonial expansion. A second period in the 20th century of decolonization from 1914 to around 1970s, and then this post-colonial period that we live in today. And it's in the period of decolonization and post-colonial imperialism that leadership or hegemony of Western imperialism passed from the European powers to the United States. Now the period, this long early period from 1500 to around 1914, imperialism was exercised through the plantation of colonies. This period was so long and so formative that I think for a lot of Western thinkers, anyhow, imperialism came to be equated with colonialism. That's to say, people thought, well, Western imperialism is just identical to the period of colonial imperialism. And then when decolonization occurred in the 20th century, you had this thought, oh, well, we're no longer in an imperial age because we're no longer in a colonial age. Rather, we're in a period where we live in a system of independent, formally independent and equal nation states caught up in a system of international law and in a structure of economic development that's universal in form. And this picture of a system, a world system of more or less formally independent and equal states caught up in capitalist relations of development at various stages, was seen as a kind of replacement of seeing the globe as a competing set of empires. In fact, this picture of a system of states or a league of nations or a union of independent nations became so dominant in the 20th century that it was projected back by academics to 1648, as if an international state system developed in 1648. So the whole period of Western imperialism tended to get obliterated in this period 1648 to 1914. It was rather reconceived as the emergence of a state system and its development, and the fact that these were competing European empires conquering the planet was downplayed. It was even hard to find text except for Marxist historians who would write about it. So this tended to reinforce this idea that with the end of colonial imperialism during the period of decolonization, imperialism itself disappeared. Fortunately, I think this kind of sleight of hand where the West passed itself off as post-imperial in virtue of being post-colonial and in a system of equal states, this kind of sleight of hand has been exposed in the last 10, 15 years by historians and other kinds of academics. And there are many academics actually in the West that were never taken in by this, right, that always wrote about imperialism and relations of economic, military, and political imperialism in a kind of continuity way. But they were ignored. They were on the borders of academic life. Now, if you pick up relatively mainstream journals in international relations or in history, the imperial character of the last 500 years is more and more brought back into focus and is discussed, either in tones of approval or disapproval. But what's different about the period of decolonization and then post-colonial imperialism is that imperial power isn't exercised through colonies, it isn't exercised formally, but is exercised informally through various mechanisms of control at a distance. And this form of imperialism is simply called informal imperialism. And we have lots of examples of it in the 18th and 19th century, where colonization failed, for example, in the 1860s, great debate about this in the historical literature, on the scramble over Africa, where the actual colonization process failed for a number of years, and they exercised domination and economic exploitation through the exercise of military intervention and use of political force short of the establishment of colonies. So we've had something called informal imperialism before, and a body of historical literature on it. But it's now come forward as the dominant way in which European powers, and especially the United States, are able to govern the economic and political and military behavior of subaltern states. But before I looked at this form of informal rule, I want to just mention again, everyone knows this, but that it's important not just to look at the actual mechanisms of informal imperial rule post-decolonization, but look at the whole field of unequal relationships in which that kind of informal rule is exercised. That you have to realize that the possibility of informal imperialism, as it's been used since the 1970s, exists and is operational, works, because it takes place on a field of relations that have been laid down in the prior colonial period. And of course, the two main features of that are, of this field, the pre-1970 field, are economic and political. So the first really structure of domination that structures the world system for 500 years is the capacity of European powers to spread capitalist relations of economic production and exploitation around much of the world and to fasten these into place through the age of colonial imperialism. And that's these the West developed on the basis, as we all know, of non-white slavery and indentured labor on the one hand, and the dispossession of indigenous people around the world and the taking of their lands and resources. And this put in place the development of the West, and it put in place a set of global economic relations that are massively unequal vis-a-vis the hegemonic powers in the North and subaltern powers in the South. And as we all know, they're more unequal than ever before. The second feature is not economic imperialism that persists and is a kind of substructural in this sense, but a kind of political substructure that the age of colonial imperialism really built colonies, built these political institutions in the non-European world that have a kind of European structure to them. It's what Frantz et al. Called replication imperialism, that they built new Europes, the United States, Latin America, and then in the 1800s, a whole set of colonial structures, India and the Middle East and so on, that were meant to be Western-style states that had constitutions, that had market freedoms, that had capitalist economies to them. And these persist through the decolonization period. So there are two huge structures of imperial rule that are laid down in that 500-year period that provide the kind of historical layered basis of the kinds of imperialism we see developing in the post-colonization period. So by 1914, just at the beginning of the decolonization period, 85% of the landmass of the world was in some form or another of European colonial rule. Various types of colonial structures had gone through this process unsuccessfully of political and economic domination, and the foundations had been laid for it. So all very brief, just to say there's a layer of imperial relations there that are relatively immovable structures of domination, inequality, and exploitation that are structured into this, that are there and have been there now since the 16th century. Okay, let me look briefly at the period of decolonization. It's certainly true that in the period of decolonization, the great decolonizing elites express their dreams for another world, for a non-colonial world, for an anti-imperial world, in all sorts of forms, forms that were non-European, non-state-like, were very different ideas about economic relations, forms of cooperation, forms of community, non-competitive relationships between individuals and groups, and so on. But when they passed through the decolonization period, they were faced with this imperial structure that was already in place, even though the imperial powers withdrew their formal forms of colonial rule. When they had successfully overthrown a colonial power, they were thrown into an imperial system that was well structured for 400 years and handed them a script on how they could develop, what the post-colonial political organization would look like. They could express their demands in terms of self-determination, which many of the decolonization elites did, but the form that this self-determination took was strictly limited, that they had to develop a form of straight state structure that fit into this global system. It was a state that had a particular character, was open to capitalist relations, was open to free trade with corporations that come on stream in the late 19th century and so on. So in the decolonization period, elites were both constrained and induced by Western powers to modernize in a particular way, to modernize in a Western way. They had to modernize their population, their hinterlands, often with great violence, to alternative ways of organizing political power and economic power. They had to lay down boundaries where there were none before. They had to take a very heterogeneous ethnic populations, and try to mold them into a Western-style nationalist identification. They had to impose on the hinterland a set of economic organizations that were open to Western trade. They had to take on immense debts in order to survive in the so-called development race. They had to submit to military and counterinsurgency training and build up gradually, indebted to an arms race. Gradually, the elites became completely alienated from their own populations in a series of anti-nationalist struggles within the post-colonial states. Causes great separation between the nationalizing elites and the vast majority, especially in Latin America. And in order to protect themselves, the elites had to lean more and more heavily on Western military power and Western military might and intervention to hold them in power in the extraction of petroleum and so on to the West. And so you built what has always been true of imperialism. One of the paradoxes of decolonization is that it brought into being these very powerful collaboration classes in a lot of these, what today are called failed states, but they were in fact created by the paradoxes of Western imperialism. So they became increasingly dependent both on Western economic extraction and the money they got from that, and Western military support so that they could use against their own populations. In the latest book on Latin America, The Last Colonial Massacre, this came out a couple of weeks ago, there's a horrendous story of this. In many cases, the constitution for the decolonizing states wasn't even written in the former colonies, written somewhere in the metropolis in London or Paris or something like that, just like Iraq and Afghanistan's constitution are written in New York or they're written in Paris. They're written in the metropole to make sure they've got it right. It's the kind of constitution that fits it into this imperial system that's been around for 500 years. And if a former colony looked like it wasn't going to self-determine itself in this subaltern way, then it was said it was not ready for self-government. And it was put in a series of what was called a mandate system or a trustee system. The League of Nations introduced this system of mandates first, right? And it said Middle Eastern people were capable of becoming independent nation states, but only after a period of tutelage. Tropical Africans, after a longer and more disciplinary period of guardianship, and Southwest Africans, Pacific Islanders, and indigenous peoples in the America were said to be too primitive to ever to be self-governing. So if they didn't decolonize the right way, they're put in this trusteeship system to kind of tutelage system along the way. The UN eliminated the mandate system, but it replaced it with a trusteeship system of rule over so-called non-self-governing territories. Now to my second theme, right? This amazing rise that Arthur's been talking about, the rise to hegemony or leadership of the United States in this period of decolonization and the Cold War. It's in this period that the United States came to its position of leadership, where hegemony passed from Europe to the U.S., and began to exercise what we call today informal imperial rule. While the old imperial colonial powers in Europe, right, they were used to governing through colonies, and then decolonization, they didn't quite know what to do, and then they're deeply weakened by World War II. United States came out of this cocoon with a way of governing subaltern states, not through colonies, but through military intervention, economic dependency, and various other instruments that I'll talk about in a moment. The thing about U.S. is this story is usually started up in the Spanish-American War in 1898, but it really goes and then it breaks through in the period of decolonization with Woodrow Wilson. But America has a long, long experience with imperial rule, really from 1608 on, right? We have what Jefferson calls an empire of liberty that sees itself as expanding across the United States. Well, the only way it can expand across the continent is to expand against the great indigenous nations and communities of North America. And this meant a series of frontier wars, a series of building forts, garrisons, wars with Indians from 1608 to Wounded Knee in the 1890s. So the first experience of American imperialism is this military expansion across what Turner called the frontier, right? Where they're pushing against 8 to 10 million indigenous people, killed 90% of them, hit the West Coast by and solidified this first phase of imperial rule. And the experience of imperial wars round about the 1890s. And this doctrine of expansion of empire and liberty that everyone talked about, I mean, gets a formulation in President Monroe's doctrine in 1823, and then it comes to be called Manifest Destiny by its popularizers. It's picked up through the 1920s. Various corollaries to the Monroe Doctrine are added on right up to Teddy Roosevelt, early 20th century. The United States will expand not just across North America, but will intervene whenever it finds it necessary to protect its economic interests in any Latin American country. That's the Roosevelt Amendment. So in the 1890s, you get this kind of hitting the western frontier, the land frontier of the United States, and the turn to really what Americans saw as economic expansion in Latin America, to spread their economic surplus, to be able to invest it in Latin American countries, and to push out old European colonial style empires. So this is the beginning here of informal imperialism that's worked out in the 1890s, people reflecting on the Spanish-American War and then the so-called Filipino-American War in 1898 to 1904, 500,000 people were killed. And it was worked out in Secretary of State John Hay's series of notes called the Open Door Notes. And what Hay meant by open door was that every country in Latin America and in China and Asia should have a policy of open door to American and European economic expansion. That corporations just came into being right in the 1890s in the modern form. Joel Backen's book's very good on this. And they needed some way to expand. The open door policy was to say that it was the role of the United States to make sure that their doors were open to trade with, dominated by the United States. And they had the right to act in terms of military intervention to open the doors of other countries to U.S. Capital expansion. So this doctrine, I think, comes to us, some of informal imperialism comes to us in this period, 1895 to 1905, is articulated in lots of economic policy by the Secretary of State and so on. But the real genius of it comes with Woodrow Wilson from 1914 to 1918, when he says, look, the way this works is that all these countries have the right of self-determination as peoples. We give them that. We're different from European colonial powers who denied the right of self-determination of colonial people. We'll allow these people to be self-determining, but we'll limit or structure or guide the conduct of their self-determination to make sure that they're open to economic and military relations with the United States. You would think self-determination meant to determine your own political and economic organization. But Wilson didn't mean that at all, and he didn't see any inconsistency with these two views. He says the Monroe Doctrine should become a universal doctrine. It's a doctrine of self-determination, but it's guided by the good foreign policy of the superior nations, by the civilized peoples, which will guide these powers of self-determination in the correct way, in the open-door policy way. And he's articulating this in 1917, the right of self-determination of all people. At the very same time, he's sending the troops into Mexico, into Haiti, into the Dominican Republic, into China, in the same period, There were 17 military interventions in Latin America and China during Wilson's watch. And he just doesn't see a contradiction from this. He says, we need the military intervention for two reasons. We have to block the old colonial powers from monopolizing particular subaltern states. And secondly, we have to free the people in subaltern countries from backward forces within that would close their economy on a doctrine of self-reliance. So we have these two roles to play in the United States as the imperial power that guides the powers of self-determination in the right direction through military intervention and economic dependency. Okay. I have a wonderful quote here, but I don't think I have time for it. And the point is that this doctrine of informal rule gets further developed in the 50s and the 60s, a failure in Vietnam, but it's rearticulated by the Clinton and the Kennedy and Clinton and Bush administration and so on. And just in summary today, it has, I'll get right up to Arthur's point, it has the following features to it. I mean, this policy of informal imperial rule that's now just not over Latin America and South Asia, but over the world. The general objective is, it is a world of self-determining yet limited nation states that all determine in this way, that they're open to free trade, that in turn is dominated by the United States and its allies. The United States imperialism, when it's working, either working unilaterally or it's working multilaterally with the former European powers, recognizes the non-European world as free and equal states, right, with the right of self-determination, but always already in this very layered field of unequal economic and political relationships, and always with this right to intervene if people fail to exercise their economic and political powers in the correct way. Third feature is that it governs through a league or a coalition of some kind, such as the UN when that works, and without the UN when it doesn't work, through a set now of international economic agencies, through a whole system of law that bypasses international law, lex mercatoria, and so on, a series of international business laws that ensure that transnational corporations in the West actually have property rights in most of the resources in the world. What replaces colonies more than anything else? It's three relations of dependency, but there are two features in this doctrine that replace colonies. The first is just global military training of local elites, either bringing them to the States or sending American troops there to train the local military elites in counterinsurgency warfare to keep the vast majority of their population down, or to treat them as terrorists if they act. The second feature that really holds it in place is not so much the local armies and the military training, but the actual building of U.S. military bases around the world. There are now 725 military bases or garrisons or forts outside of the United States, in just about every country in the world. These are, we think of, there are planes flying around every 24 hours a day. There are submarines and aircraft carriers in every ocean. There are troops ready to go everywhere. But at the base of it, there's the same method they use against American Indians. Forts at the frontier, garrison. You have to read Chalmers Johnson's latest books, The Sorrow of Empires. He says the war in Iraq wasn't even about the petroleum. It was about getting more bases in Iraq and around the Caspian Sea. Sure, they'll use them to ensure they have access to those resources, but it's become a kind of self-reproducing system, spreading these forts and garrisons. And if you read Joint Vision 2020, which Arthur has written a lot about, which is the Vision 2020,
for the military.
It's a lot about the weaponization of space and being able to control every town and city on the planet from space, but it's also about building more and more bases. So what holds the whole system in place is this build-up since Second World War of military bases that are self-contained in every country in the world, ready to act as a threat, but are really ready to move and act if the threat doesn't hold out. And if the bases don't work, finally there's the exercise of military intervention, this ever-expanding frontier of civilization over and against what policymakers call the savage wars of peace. It's carrying on the same language, not the religious language, but the language of a civilization that keeps regenerating itself through violence against the savage other. First the American Indian, then the Latin American savage, then the Filipino savage, now the savage in the Middle East. What's next? Who knows? But it's melded with this religious language, but there's a whole stream of it that comes out out of this frontier experience of seeing themselves as civilized over and against savages, a completely horrendous mythology. But you look at what these bases are called, what these are, Black Hawk, Geronimo, they keep recycling the wars they fought with Native Americans and placing them on the next people that they see at the other side of that frontier. This is the kind of imperialism I think we're faced with. Thank you.